House Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:02 p.m. on Thursday, February 25th, 2024. We're meeting today in Davis Room 106 of the Capitol Building. Please silence your cell phones out of courtesy to others that may be attending. Committee members in attendance today are Representative Ruffridge, Representative Sumner, Representative Fields, and Representative Mina. We have a quorum to do business. Also, I need to introduce my committee aide, Riley Nye, who isn't here. He will be back in just a moment, but if you need to get the attention of committee members, please go through Mr. Nye. And also our House Records Recorder is Cheryl Cole and Zach Lawhorn, our teleconference moderator. We have six items on the agenda today. We're going to hear from Emily Foster, who is applying for the Board of Massage Therapists. The next is Executive Order 125 to eliminate the adult ACEMS. Now I forgot what that stands for. Very good, thank you. And the next one is House Bill 187, prior authorization exemptions with an exemption for healthcare providers. The fourth is House Bill 260, catastrophic medical illness assistance. And 258 general relief and burial assistance, sponsored by Representative Staff. The first item up is House Bill 242, extend senior benefits, sponsored by Representative Vance. And Representative Vance, would you like to come forward and bring us up to date on that bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Sarah Vance of House District 6, representing the Lower Kenai Peninsula. And House Bill 242 simply extends the senior benefit program by 10 years.
Okay. And did we have a public hearing on this? We did last time, correct?
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So I would like to move this bill on to the Finance Committee so we can be sure to get it through the House and over to the other body. So, Mr. Co-Chair, I would entertain a motion to move.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill 242, version 33-LS1121/B from committee with attached individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
And we have an objection. Representative Fields.
Thank you. The primary reason for my objection is I was going to offer amendments to this bill, namely to index the benefits to inflation. I guess I would just note the bill is already in second reading on the Senate floor. So as a practical matter, the Senate bill is going to pass first anyway. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments? And I would note for the record, Representative Sadler is here at 3:07, and we'll do an at ease. The motion to I'm not going to require.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Ruffin, I will just withdraw the motion.
Okay,
very good. Move this bill from committee. Right. Before we hear some other debate, please.
Okay, very good. Representative Fields, you wanted to offer a conceptual amendment at this point.
Sure, I'll move conceptual amendment number one to index the level of senior benefits in the bill to inflation, specifically consumer price index. Okay.
Okay, there has a motion and there has been an objection. Do we have any comments? Before we take comments, I'd like to note that Representative McCormick joined us at 3:08. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Speaking to the motion, I generally oppose indexing financial decisions. The state has an ever-moving fiscal situation, and our Constitution does not allow for us to have dedicated funds, I think, to give maximum flexibility to the legislature to meet future exigencies. And I think that locking in appropriations and benefit levels for inflation erodes that authority and that flexibility. For that purpose, I will oppose that amendment.
Very good. Any other comments? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. To the chair, on the amendment, I generally am in support of inflation adjusting, especially given that there are so many Alaskans that do rely on the senior benefits program and have relied on it for many decades, and hopefully will continue to do so. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Fields, Representative Fields.
Thank you. I had anticipated introducing this at a later meeting and sending the amendment through the bill sponsor, but also wanted to give the bill sponsor a chance to talk to the amendment, which otherwise I would have shared with her in advance, but in this case, Maybe she could just talk to me now. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Representative Vance. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just want to extend, please, I want no one to interpret my resistance to inflation proofing to mean anything that I don't support this new benefits program. I do.
Okay. Representative Vance.
Through the chair, this is Representative Sarah Vance to answer the question by Rep. Fields. I don't feel prepared to make that decision at this time because of a lack of understanding of the fiscal impact that would make directly. I've been very cautious on making those financial decisions. We're already seeing an increase into this because we have a growing number of seniors who are becoming eligible, and I think that's a rather robust discussion, although a very valid one. Again, that is something that I would like to see what that would look like penciling out.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, I guess I would ask the maker of the amendment what you would envision happening in a situation where we had deflation. And particularly, I ask this because of the housing component of the CPI and the substantial run-up in recent years of housing. There have been periods where housing prices have reversed, and you could potentially enter into a deflationary period where you'd be diminishing benefits. Would you envision that the inflation adjuster would also adjust it downwards?
Thank you, through the chair. I think my staff sent up the amendment that I had written, so I think we could leave it as is, which would leave the potential for deflation, or clarify that it is a floor, not a ceiling. I think it would be our choice, and we would, if we wanted to have it be a floor, not a ceiling, we would probably want to write that into the amendment. Which I would support, but it's our choice.
Okay, any other comments? And let's see, we have to have Mr. Riley call the roll on conceptual amendment number one. House Record, sorry. Please call the roll.
Representative McCormick.
Yes.
Representative Ruffin.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Sumner.
No.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Meenan.
Yes.
Chair Prox.
No.
Three yeas and four nays.
Okay, and so by a vote of three yeas and four nays, the amendment fails to pass. We have the main motion before us.
Mr. Chairman, I actually wanted to offer another amendment that I'd had written up. I can go make a copy of it if it's easier for y'all on 242.
Let's then
table. I only have one more.
There's others that have to get other places. Let's table 242 and we will take it up later. I need a motion. Please.
Thank you, Chair Prox. I would make a motion that we table House Bill 242 until scheduled at another date.
Are there any objections to tabling 242? All right. Next item. We're to consider the appointment of governor's appointee, or the consideration of governor's appointee Emily Foster to the Board of Massage Therapists. Ms. Foster, are you with us? Not there. There we are. Good. Yes, please go ahead. Put your name on the record and introduce yourself for us, please.
There was a little bit of a delay. Can you say that again?
Yes. Could you put your name on the record and proceed and just introduce yourself and let us know why you want to be on the Board of Massage Therapists?
My name is Emily Foster. I was encouraged to apply for the position when it came open on the Board of Massage Therapy because I have experience as a massage therapist, as a licensed massage therapist for the last 23 years now. I have experience both as an employee of the chiropractic industry as well as the day spa industry, and I am also a business owner and run my own business currently doing massage. So I feel that I have a lot to offer as far as perspective from both, regulations that govern both employees and employers or business owners in the massage industry. So I feel like I can bring a very broad and well-rounded perspective to the board and hopefully be of use.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions of Ms. Foster from the committee, Mr. Representative Sadler?
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. We're back on record. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some confusion, ma'am, about the last name. The resume in my binder had Emma Hardy. I'm informed by staff that Emily Foster and Emma Hardy are the same person. Can you confirm that for me, please?
No, there was some confusion with my daughter using the laptop with the word processor, and her resume was accidentally attached to my email in some way. So I sent that to Alan and got that cleared up. My name is Emily Foster. My daughter is Emma Hardy. I sent in the corrected paperwork a few days ago via email.
Through the chair, I was just going to say you sound remarkably, for someone who graduated from charter school last year, having 23 years as a massage therapist, I was impressed.
Yes. And I have an early learner. Representative Fields.
Thanks through the chair. It sounds like the nominee here has the same issues that I have when I try to work at home. So appreciate her putting her name forward. Through the chair, Ms. Foster, one of the more important things I think the Massage Therapy Board has worked on are some processes like fingerprinting and identification to discourage human trafficking through illicit massage parlors. Can you just share your views on, you know, the importance of combating human trafficking to as both a human rights issue, but also to support all the legitimate massage therapy establishments? Thank you.
Oh, gosh. It's a hugely important issue. One of the reasons we're so concerned as a board for the recent executive order on massage. That was actually one of the things that was brought up very first as a concern, is that we are, and part of what we do is recognizing the small little red flags and things, the ways that things can be worded on applications that are nefarious, that are illegitimate and have to do with human trafficking. Certainly creating and crafting regulations to govern the massage industry that would help minimize the risks associated with human trafficking minimizing the damage and the public safety issues in that direction. Also, as a new graduate 23 years ago, I graduated from a school in Nevada, in Las Vegas, which we all know is called the City of Sin for a very good reason. And they really stress to us high standards and ethics in the industry. And we have really clawed our way out of being associated with prostitution, with illegal and legal prostitution, depending on the state that you're in. So we've had, to be recognized by the medical industry as a true medical profession, giving benefits and working, in the same field as doctors. It's a huge accomplishment, and one that we want to continue moving forward.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Any other questions of Ms. Foster? Seeing none, do we have, let me open this first. Open for public testimony. Do we have anyone in the room that has comments on Ms. Foster's appointment to the Board of Massage Therapists? Do we have anyone online that wanted to comment on Ms. Foster's appointment to the Board of Massage Therapists? Hearing none, public testimony is closed. Any other final comments from the committee? Okay, thank you, Ms. Foster. And the House and Social Services Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee, Emily Foster, to the Board of Massage Therapists and forwards her nomination to the full legislature to consider for confirmation. Signing this report does not reflect any individual's recommendation of approval or disapproval. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the document. Back on record. So moving on to the next item, we have Executive Order 125, transferring the function of the Alaska Council of Emergency Medical Services to the Department of Health. Here to explain this executive order is Commissioner Hedberg of the Department of Health, and Gene Wiseman, the Section Chief, Rural Community Health System. Thank you. So if you'd please give us your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
For the record, my name is Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner for the Department of Health, and with me today I have Gene Wiseman, Chief of Rural and Community Health Systems. And there are slides. I'm not sure if they're ready to be queued up. Executive Order 125 removes the Alaska Council on Emergency Medical Services, also known as ACMIS, from statute and transfers those authorities and responsibilities over to the Department of Health. I want to make sure it's clear that transferring those responsibilities does not change the original intent. My intent is to create an EMS advisory council or advisory committee that would really represent the full spectrum of pre-hospital care, also known as emergency medical services or EMS. There has a lot has changed with EMS over the years from its original intent. And with me today is Gene Wiseman, and he's going to talk about the next two slides in the history of ACMS and how removing ACMS from statute and transferring those responsibilities over to the Department of Health, we really can advance the pre-hospital care.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Gene Wiseman. I am the Section Chief of Rural Community Health Systems. I've also been a paramedic in the state since 98 and have served in EMS since 91. I have my previous member of the ACMS Council or Alaska Council of EMS, and I've been an EMS regional director as well. So a bit of perspective on this council. I think to explain fully what EO 125 will do, we have to take a little walk down history lane. EMS started in 1971 nationally through an act of Congress, and this board or this council was formed in statute in 1977 to help plan and implement an EMS system statewide. It was codified into statute 1808, and in that, there's 11 members that were at the time when EMS fell under the Department of Public Safety. At that time, they were what was deemed to be the subject matter experts in that very new field of EMS. Since then, fast forward 47 years later, we're in a very different place for emergency medical services. There's been advancements in multiple areas, including technology and intersections with other partners like behavioral health. We've gone into realms of mobile integrated health, which is helping hospitals and behavioral health systems meet patients in the field without needing to transport. Those types of things, dispatch and communication has advanced significantly. So with those same 11 members being codified in statute, we have been unable and stifled to change the conversation to include the individuals or the representation of the current EMS system. So what EO 125 will do by moving and transitioning the advisory capacity advisory committee under the Department of Health and the Commissioner will allow us to evolve EMS into the future by including the right voices in the areas that we intersect. It's going to help us with coordination, because it'll be efficient and effective, collaborative, and just a better rounded representation of our industry. Actually, I think that was my presentation. Moving on to slides. I'm also an EMS instructor, and I tend to talk five slides ahead. So,
all right.
Thanks.
Any questions from the committee?
Absolutely.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Prox.
Ruffridge. Thank you.
Yes. Through the chair, I guess the question I had goes back to the comment that you made, Commissioner, about an advisory council. So help me understand, is that something that a commissioner can create, or is that something that would need to be created in statute?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, as commissioner, a lot of our divisions have the authority to create advisory committees. We don't need legislative action to create advisory committees. I think the intent is really important. We want stakeholders to really inform what are the gaps in the systems and what are the recommendations to address those gaps. I think the original intent of ACMS was fulfilled. They recommended an EMS system. It was really based off of 1970, and so much has progressed since then. And so really by moving the representation, the seats, the 11 seats out of statute and transitioning that authority over to me, it allows me to create an advisory committee that can really represent the current makeup of pre-hospital care. as Gene Wiseman had mentioned, you know, dispatch is a key component and they're not represented on ACMIS. And we know a lot of call-outs start by Alaskans in need calling 911 or local law enforcement for assistance. And so we really want to make sure that we stay in line with what is the current needs. And I think this advisory committee will really help us move EMS forward.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox. And this is just outside of my scope of expertise, so pardon me if I ask just a couple more questions. But has this board or this council met often in the last year? Do they draft regulations? And I think I'll just make a general statement. One of my bigger concerns with all of the executive orders is missing the boots on the ground approach, because there's just no way for members of the department, unless they are specifically hired with this sort of expertise in mind, to have the expertise necessary to move a system along. So I guess kind of speaking to just that generally would be helpful to me.
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I think you have two questions, so I'll answer the first, and then I will defer to Gene Wiseman. So ACMIS meets quarterly, and they have three subcommittees. There's a subcommittee, EMS for Children, that really focuses on pediatric pre-hospital care. The second is around training, so developing the training curriculum. The third is for medical directors. So every EMS agency has a medical director who operates under that authority. All three committees, all of them are volunteer, and they all meet on a regular basis. The three subcommittees are functioning well. I think what this executive order does is it's really, by taking it out of statute and in transitioning it to an advisory committee, we can have the full representation. Whether they meet quarterly, monthly, I think that's to be determined by the new body. But the intent is to continue to have this volunteer advisory committee. This is very much in line with our trauma committee. So our trauma committee meets once a quarter. They review the trauma centers and the data that is coming in from a trauma registry. They make recommendations. Having an EMS advisory committee that links up with a trauma committee is really that continuum of care. The state EMS office will provide the administrative support to this advisory committee, just like the trauma program provides the administrative support to the trauma committee.
Thank you.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. For the chair, I was wondering if you could go more into the new modern updates to the EMS system that currently that ACMS is limited in terms of addressing.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Mina, this is Gene Wiseman for the record. So, I'm sorry, could you repeat that one more time?
Yes.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox, through the chair. Given that there are new updates to EMS and how we view it that have progressed beyond the 70s, how is the current formation of ACMIS limited in addressing how EMS has changed?
Yes, thank you. Again, for the record, Gene Wiseman. So the 11 members of ACMIS are comprised of, I believe, three physicians, an emergency room nurse, a pre-hospital provider, three pre-hospital providers, one of which is off the road system, and four consumers, if I recall correctly on those numbers. So that matrix of composition, it's for where we're currently at, there. Those not all the voices are at the table. So ACMIS is really unable to address the advancing needs of EMS through their membership. The perspectives at the table are very limited. And so that needs to become more robust through whatever mechanism. This tool will help us do that. But that essentially is there where we've advanced and who's missing. Those areas those seats are numerous. As EMS has developed in areas of quality assurance, electronic patient care reporting and data, mobile integrated health, dispatch and communications. We now have degree programs for paramedic, so we're intersecting with colleges. We through our mobile integrated health programs that are starting, we intersect with behavioral health and are a component of the crisis now model in some communities. We have Air Medical has advanced greatly through the years in the technologies that we do, the systems of care that EMS has evolved to respond to. In its early days, it was because EMS was started because of trauma on the roadways. Now we have cardiac arrest survival in response, stroke survival response, sepsis response. The list goes on of what we are responding to. And, you know, following the pandemic, EMS was used in very atraditional ways as well to help decompress the hospital. So they touch the world of emergency management too. So there's many aspects in just the limited scope of the existing council doesn't meet that need.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a couple of questions, some of them detailed, some of them practical, some philosophical. So my question, sir, to the chair is, if the emergency medical system has become more complicated, then why not revise the mission or staffing or composition of the ECMS?
Through the chair, Representative Settler, Heidi Hedberg, for the record. When we look, two answers. First, I think that we have recognized that the representation on ECMS, the seats, not the people, but the seats, have needed to change for a number of years. We've actually had a contractor come in and analyze our EMS system and made the same recommendations. I think there's always competing priorities within the department. And when we look at the tools that are available, using the executive order was a tool in order to shift and move, just delineating what those seats are and removing it from statute and putting it into an advisory council. We did meet with the ACMS members. We met with the 7 EMS regions. We met with the fire chiefs and really talked about the intent, like by taking this out of statute and moving it over into an advisory committee. The intent is still the same, but we really want to have the depth and breadth of representation from all of the subject matter experts. The department has the staffing resources through the state EMS office in order to provide the administrative support to the advisory committee. The department has many advisory committees that are not in statute, so we are very used to this process.
Representative Sadler.
Being somewhat hamstrung not having the statutory definition of the membership, again, my question kind of still stands. If the mission has gotten more complicated, why not revise the membership of the council to meet that complexity?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's what the executive order is doing. It's taking out those 11 seats and transferring it and just creating the EMS advisory council so that we can change over time.
Through the chair.
Representative
at the risk of a clumsy analogy, it sounds like the car needs painting, so we're going to sell the car. I mean, it's possible to adjust the mission, but not have to end the council. You're describing a need to modify what the council, what it accomplishes, and saying that the solution, the preferred solution, is to eliminate the council, have someone else do that. My question still stands, why cannot the council simply be rejiggered, reconstituted, provide more membership to reflect the needs? I don't know that eliminating the council is the only solution to addressing the changing mission of emergency medical services. Please persuade me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Seller, we are not eliminating the council. There's two mechanisms. There can be a bill that's introduced to change and reflect the changes within that chapter. Or there's a tool through the governor has executive orders, and he's just removing the statute, this portion of statute, and then transitioning the authorities over to the Department of Health. That's why I wanted to make sure the intent was very clear. My intent is to have an EMS advisory council, and we have been working with the EMS communities to make sure they understood the intent, and they do support this.
Okay, Representative Sam.
And not to get into debate, but through the chair, I hear you say that the council will still exist, but what I think you mean is the function will still exist. The council, as currently constituted, will not exist, but the functions will be absorbed. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seller, correct.
So again, my question stands. If the council does something and you want the council to do something different, could you not rejigger the council itself and leave it extant in statute? You're telling me that the solution is to disband the council and absorb the function. But you said that the justification for doing so is that the council can't just stop to the mission. Can't we rejigger the council to meet the mission? Respectfully, yeah. I'm just trying to pin down why.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sutler. So the intent in the chapter states that the Alaska Council on EMS will recommend an EMS system for the state of Alaska. That duty has been accomplished. There's an EMS system in Alaska. The EMS system has matured over time. And as an example, that's where ACMAS doesn't have representation from dispatch. It doesn't have representation from air medical, as an example. Or now this new emerging mobile integrated health. And that's where there's conversations about those topics, but there's not the representation on the Alaska Council for EMS.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, I wanted to just check and make sure I understood this one more time. So the Alaska Council for Emergency Medical Services right now seems to have advisory functions to begin with. For regulations that occur, the department is already the regulatory body?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, that was actually your original question. That's going to defer to Jean to answer. So the state EMS office performs and updates the regulatory duties.
Sometimes through the chair, I can reach behind me and just pull the book. So yes, I think that just as a comment helps me understand if the advisory function continues and the regulatory function is already something within the Department of Health, I'm starting to understand the executive order more clearly. Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Any final? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Commissioner Hedberg, I'm looking at the statement of cost, which says proposed change by allowing the creation of focused committees and task forces whose composition can be uniquely designed to address. Who would be the members of those task forces and focused committees?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. So right now, ACMAS has three subcommittees, EMS for children, training, and the medical directors. And those three subcommittees will continue.
And
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'll ask my question. So, and those subcommittees are composed of current members of the ACMAS, is that correct?
Through the chair, Gene Wiseman, Section Chief Rural Community Health System, Representative Sadler. The subcommittees are the membership of those. The committee was established. Actually, we'll have to talk about history a little bit. Those three committees existed concurrently with ACMAS, and then they were moved underneath ACMAS actually to help give that council kind of some focus and some purpose because their mission's been complete for a while. So when these subcommittees are established, they're in the bylaws of them, but they're the representation that are the seats are with outlined within the bylaws, but they're subject matter experts in the different areas.
Representative Sandler.
I'll ask the question more directly. So the subcommittee members of ACMAS, it's a yes or no?
As subcommittee, yes, sir.
They are. So the members of these focus subcommittees who will be doing the work of the ACMAS are themselves ACMAS members currently. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, they are not appointed by boards and commissions. So by definition, no, they're not official members of ACMAS. If that makes
No, I'm afraid it doesn't. I'm still trying to find out, do we have the ACMAS members? Are the subcommittees members of ACMAS who are in subcommittees? Or do we have the ACMAS members and entirely different people in the subcommittees? Which is it, please?
Through the chair. If for each subcommittee, there is, one, I believe, one, let's look at the bylaws, but one ACMAS member sits as a part of the subcommittee, but it is not comprised of all of the same people. So
thank you for the answer. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? All right. With that, thank you, Commissioner Hedberg and Director Weiser. And this whole process is new to me. I think if we're okay with letting this executive order go into effect, we can do nothing. If we have an objection to that, then somebody has to draw a resolution to make that objection. Is that clear as mud? All right, so with that, thank you very much, and we will go on to the next order of business.
Brief at ease.
Yes, sir. Representative Field. Pardon? Good thing somebody's paying attention here. All right, we will take public testimony on Executive Order 125. Do we have anyone in the room that wants to testify on Executive Order 125? Yes? Do we have anyone online that wants to testify about Executive Order 125? And we have, it looks like, Wilma Vinton. Ms. Vinton, are you available?
Yes, I am. Give me just 1 second to pull up. My information, I apologize. I had a... Honorable Chair and members of the House, my name is Wilma Vinton. I have been in Alaska EMS for over 40 years and am currently licensed as a paramedic. I have been actively involved as a provider and as an administrator in an agency as well as an administrator in the regional EMS. Whose goals included ensuring viable and sustainable EMS in our rural communities. Currently, I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Council and participate in its focused subcommittees. I support Executive Order 125 because I believe in today's challenging and rapid changing healthcare environment, and EMS Advisory Committee needs to be dynamic, nimble, and able to adapt quickly. ACMAS membership is bound by legislation regarding membership, whereas an EMS Advisory Committee under DOH Commissioner would be less restrictive. I've had the opportunity to work with a task force put together by the Office of EMS under DOH to develop scope of practice documents and educational documents to accommodate changes made in the regulations in 2019. We were able to include a wide variety of experts in their field, air medical, mobile integrated health, tribal health representatives, and many more that had a stake in how the new scope of practice would be rolled out. The finished products were well thought out and well received. I believe the intent of the EO is to streamline the process and to have an EMS advisory committee made of stakeholders in all areas of EMS to continue advising the commissioner and the Office of EMS. This is the kind of involvement Alaska EMS needs to meet the challenges that face our future, decreased volunteerism and retention in our ranks, safety of our providers in the field, and decreased funding opportunities, as well as a myriad of other issues that threaten the viability and sustainability of our EMS system. I believe at this point in time, Alaska EMS will be better served by an advisory committee under DOH in partnership with the Office of EMS rather than the restrictions that we have with the Governor's Advisory Council. Many times with the board, we don't get members added to ACMAS quickly, and sometimes we get members who are added that for some reason or another may not have as much background in EMS, and it's a steep learning curve for them to get that while they're on the board. I thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify before you today, and I ask that you please support the Executive Order 125.
Very good. Thank you. Do we have any questions of Ms. Fenton.
One question.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair to Ms. Fenton, I hope I got your name right. Thank you for testifying today. I have one question. Are there a lot of applicants, or how often do you get applicants to the council, just in relation to your comment about the vacancies?
Well, we, through the chair, we do have, right now we have two openings, and we've had two of those openings for almost a year, one of them for almost a year. And most recently, one of the positions that should have been filled by a physician was actually filled by a paramedic, because the boards and commissions didn't understand the difference between a paramedic and a physician at the time. And while the paramedic that's filling that position is awesome, we lost the physician because of it. So, you know, sometimes it's a little confusing when you're dealing with boards and commissions whose staff may not understand the needs of the actual committee.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Fenton. We have Roberta Leachy, it appears, from Sitka. Ms. Leachy, are you online?
I am.
Please put yourself on record and proceed with your testimony. And you have 2 minutes.
This is Roberta Leachy. I'm calling from Sitka, Alaska. 40 years ago, I started my career in EMS as a volunteer in a rural place on Prince of Wales Island, and started as a first responder, eventually working my way up the chain until I became a paramedic. I was a contract instructor. I was sent to all kinds of villages and logging camps to teach. And during that time, as I was developing in my career, ACAMS proved to be a solid foundation on which to build an EMS system. But currently we have, the state is so big, it's divided into 7 EMS regions. Each region has its own challenges, as we all know, for everything, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's healthcare or whatever. But I see this executive order that the governor has done, 125, as an evolution, not necessarily an elimination. One of the things, Gene did a wonderful job explaining the history of ACAMS. But one thing, there's a couple of things I think I could add. One of them is the removal of paramedics from the medical board's oversight to the office of EMS. That was a big change that happened a couple of years ago. There's currently no representation, and Les Roma, as she mentioned before, they have a new paramedic sitting on that ACAMS committee right now. The other thing that we need help with when it comes to giving advice to the stakeholders is there's no billing representation, which would help increase the funds that come into communities that are certified services. And there's no data necessarily a person that is able to relay the information about outcomes. And let's face it, in EMS, it's not necessarily where you are in Alaska, it's who you're standing next to, whether you're going to survive or not. And so considering the distances and the time and everything, we do need to have specialized folks with that internal knowledge of what it takes to become good advisors for the Department of Health. So I would encourage you to also support the Executive Order 125. Looking at the future, we hope to bridge that huge gap that has been created between 1977 and now. Thank you.
Thank you. And brief at ease. Back on record. Thank you, Ms. Leachy. The next testifier we have is Brian Webb. Mr. Webb, are you available?
I am, and greetings to the chairs and members of the committee. My name is Brian Webb from Anchorage, and I'm representing myself as an EMS clinician. And as many know, I've been in Alaska EMS since 1978, where I now volunteer my focus on Alaska EMS improvement and advocacy efforts. And regarding ACAMS, I was here when it was first established. Now, we had no EMS infrastructure, and we were originally owned by the Department of Public Safety. And at that time, the governor needed subject matter experts and those consumer stakeholders to help swaddle this newborn system. Yeah, I think the key here is that it's the governor's council on EMS. And the circuitous route that we've had to take for those of us that have been at this for so long in order to get things done many times goes through the governor's office, and then it gets passed down to Department of Health and then Office of EMS, a very circuitous route. And I will admit a very frustrating route. So here we are, 47 years later, and certainly a lot's changed. And Alaska EMS has matured. So we now have the Office of EMS, who's our regulatory body, and it manages EMS in its entirety. And it's truly reflective of EMS taking care of EMS. And it owes much success to SB 21 from the last legislature as a shameless plug for my work that was done on SB 21. So today, Alaska EMS is at another historical juncture with this executive order. And I tied some historical pieces in due to the current angst over other AOs that affect regulatory boards and the creation of fears that the results may not be representative of those industries. But you know what? ACIMS is that right now. And albeit it's an advisory committee on EMS and not a regulatory body, my big rub is that its membership still reflects EMS from the 1970s. We have members with no EMS background, others that do have some, others that have emergency room and nursing and such. And the current composition you've heard is near impossible to update. You know, as such, there's a stark lack of representation of EMS training, medical direction, and our EMS subspecialties. So it's currently experiencing what those other EO stakeholders are concerned about. So I fully agree with EO 125. And I really like where it says that the department should form this thing called an Alaska EMS Advisory Committee. That could mean we can finally have something that's agile, diverse, and relevant, and it can directly advise the commissioner on these high-level EMS issues.
Could you wrap up your testimony, please?
Yes, I sure will. So those ACIMS committees I participate in, really, it's not good. Enacting EO 125 is not going to affect us in the least. And ACIMS has done its job admirably. I'm here to say that ACIMS has run its course for Alaska. And so in closing, we need to consider the functionality of that council whose membership is aligned with Alaska EMS, and one that isn't replicating the work done by others. And for EMS providers, EO 125, we want it. It makes sense. And consideration to sunset ACIMS should also stand on its own apart from those other EOs. So thanks for your time. Appreciate you allowing me to speak today.
Okay, thank you. Next, we have Cynthia Lynn from Petersburg. Ms. Lynn.
Hello, Mr. Chair and the committee members. This is way over my head, and I am not a bureaucrat. I have been in Alaska 30 years. I'm an old pediatric nurse, and I'm in responding to the article in my local paper regarding the 12 EOs by the governor. I was on three state boards having to do with independent living.
Ms. Lynn, we're just talking about EO 125. Do you have some thoughts on EO 125 at this time?
Can I finish, please?
Please proceed.
Okay. I was on three boards having to do with independent living, disabilities, and children advocacy and safety. The only concern I have about 125 and future EOs is right now through the Department of Health, I can't do the internet. There's no way to contact a person or have public input. It's structurally overloaded, it seems. And when I heard it was going to be transferred to the Department of Health, I was very concerned about two things: public input on their local and also their region and local areas, because of course each community has different needs and different situations. Every input I've heard today is excellent, and I've learned a lot. But I do beg you to consider easy public input, not just on emails and the internet, but in person based on where we live. We're the next to the smallest state, and I hate to see our state become like Los Angeles and lose the personal touch that we've always had. I thank you for your time, and I respect everything that's been said. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you. And that is all I have signed up to testify. Is there anyone else online that wishes to testify about Executive Order 125 concerning the Alaska Council on Emergency Medical Services? And anyone in the room? With that, public testimony is closed. I thank you, Commissioner Hedberg and Director Weissman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So moving on, the next item before us is House Bill 187, which has to do with prior authorization exemptions for health providers. It's sponsored by Representative Sumner, and here to assist him is his staff, Serena Hackenmiller. Yes, please. Please put yourself on the record and introduce the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, Representative Sumner. And if the chair allows, I'd like to read the sponsor statement, then turn it over to Mrs. Hackenmiller for a sectional analysis.
Please proceed.
HB 187 aims to reduce the wait time for certain healthcare services by exempting healthcare providers from making pre-authorization requests for said services. Currently, Alaskans who need certain healthcare services must wait days and even weeks at a time to get pre-authorized to receive healthcare services because of the processing time between the healthcare provider and the insurance companies. This bill would help Alaskans receive healthcare services immediately, especially healthcare services that could save their lives. This bill would create a utilization review entity that may evaluate whether a healthcare provider continues to qualify for an exemption if during the most recent 12-month period, the utilization review entity has approved or would approve at least 80% of the prior authorization requests submitted by the healthcare provider for that healthcare service. The healthcare provider is not required to request an exemption to qualify for an exemption. The utilization review may not deny or reduce payment for a healthcare service that is exempted. Other states with prior authorization exemptions have seen increased frequency of patients who receive healthcare services they need expeditiously. This bill will help Alaskans receive fast, efficient, and quality healthcare when they need it without waiting for a pre-authorization process that could cause their health to decline even more. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hackenmiller?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Serena Hackenmiller. I am staff to Rep. Sumner, and I will continue with the sectional analysis. In Section 1, Alaska Statute 21.07.005A is amended to insert the following language into subsection 1 under A, so it reads, "The structure and operation of utilization review and benefit determination processes, including processes for utilization review entities, under AS21.07.100. In Section 2, AS21.07 is amended by adding a new section called Section 21.07.100, Utilization Review Entities, to implement the following. A utilization review entity may not require a healthcare provider to complete a prior authorization for a healthcare service for a covered person to receive coverage for the healthcare service if, during the most recent 12-month period, the utilization review entity has approved or would have approved at least 80% of the prior authorization requests submitted by the healthcare provider for that healthcare service. A utilization review entity may evaluate whether a healthcare provider continues to qualify for an exemption not more than once every 12 months. A utilization review entity is not required to evaluate an existing exemption and nothing prevents a utilization review entity from establishing a longer exemption period. A healthcare provider is not required to request an exemption to qualify for an exemption. If a healthcare provider does not receive an exemption, the healthcare provider may, once every 12 months of providing healthcare services, request the utilization review entity to provide a determination to deny a prior authorization exemption under A of this section. The utilization review entity shall provide to the healthcare provider an explanation of how to appeal the determination. A utilization review entity may revoke an exemption after 12 months if the utilization review entity does the following. Decides that the healthcare provider would not have met the 80% approval criteria based on a retrospective review of the claims for the healthcare service for which the exemption applies for the previous 3 months or the period needed to reach a minimum of 10 claims for review. Provides the healthcare provider with the information used by the utilization review entity to make a determination to revoke the exemption, or provides an explanation to the healthcare provider on how to appeal that determination. The exemption remains in effect until the 30th day after the date the utilization review entity notifies the healthcare provider of its determination to revoke the exemption, or if the healthcare provider appeals the determination the 5th day after the revocation is upheld on appeal. A determination to revoke or deny an exemption by a utilization review entity must be made by a healthcare provider licensed in Alaska with the same or similar specialty as the healthcare provider being considered for an exemption and must have experience in the healthcare service they are providing for which the requested exemption applies. A utilization review entity must provide a healthcare provider who receives an exemption of this section with a notice that includes the following: a statement that the healthcare provider qualifies for an exemption from a prior authorization requirement and the duration of the exemption, and a list of healthcare services for which the exemption applies. A utilization review entity may not deny or reduce payment for a healthcare service exempted from a prior authorization requirement, including a healthcare service performed or supervised by another healthcare provider when the healthcare provider who ordered the service received a prior authorization exemption, unless the healthcare provider providing the healthcare service does the following: knowingly and materially misrepresented the healthcare service in a quest for payment submitted by the utilization review entity with the specific intent to deceive and obtain an unlawful payment form from a utilization review entity, or failed to substantially perform the healthcare service. In the sectional analysis, the following are defined. Healthcare services means the following: the provision of pharmaceutical products, services, or durable medical equipment, a healthcare procedure, treatment, or service provided in a healthcare facility licensed in Alaska or by a doctor of medicine, doctor of osteopathy, or within the scope of practice of a healthcare professional who is licensed in Alaska. Health maintenance organization has the meaning given in Alaska Statute 21.86.900. Prior authorization means the process used by a utilization review entity to determine the medical necessity or medical appropriateness of a covered entity to determine the medical of a covered health care service before the health care service is provided, or a requirement that a covered person or health care provider notify a health care insurer or utilization review entity before providing a health care service. Utilization review entity means an individual or entity that performs prior authorization for the following: an employer in Alaska with employees covered under a health benefit plan or health insurance policy, a healthcare insurer, a preferred provider organization, a health maintenance organization, an individual or entity that provides, offers to provide, or administers hospital outpatient medical prescription drug or other healthcare benefits to a person treated by a healthcare provider licensed in Alaska under a healthcare policy, plan, or contract. Section 3, this act takes effect immediately.
Oops. Thank you. And let's see, we have invited testimony from Pam Vention, the Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association.
Thank you, Chairman Price.
Thank you. Please put your name on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pam Benson. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association, and we represent physicians across the state. We support HB 187 and encourage your passage of this bill. Prior authorization is a cost control process that requires healthcare professionals to obtain advanced approval from health plans before a prescription medication or a medical service qualifies for payment and can be delivered to the patient. These are time-consuming barriers to effective delivery of necessary treatment. This is especially burdensome for providers who routinely, and by routinely I mean 80% of the time or more, eventually get those prior authorization approvals. Prior authorization requirements delay treatment and necessary care 94% of the time that they are required. Up to 80% of patients abandon recommended care at least some of the times due to these requirements. 33% of physicians report that prior authorization has led to a serious adverse event for a patient under their care. 89% of physicians report that prior authorization has a negative impact on patient care. 62% of physicians report prior authorization has led to additional office visits. This is especially true with cancer patients. Oncology specialists report the following statistics in cancer care. 87% of oncologists report onerous documentation needed to demonstrate medical necessity. 97% report response delays from insurance companies. 96% report unsuccessful appeals of prior authorization denials. 94% report obstructive appeal processes. 91% report lack of clinical expertise by the prior authorization reviewers. 91% report a lack of clinical validity of prior authorization programs. And 91% report lack of transparency in the process. HB 187, if passed, will go a long way to alleviate the burden on providers, to increase the quality of care to patients, and ultimately reduce the cost of unnecessary office visits to meet prior authorization therapy requirements. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Ms. Fentgen, Representative Mina?
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair to Ms. Fentgen, hello. I would love to know more about claims that get denied because of prior authorization. How often does that happen, and how much time goes into appealing those claims to insurance and working with patients on trying to get those services?
The American Medical Association has extensive data, and I would be glad to forward that to the committee members. That would be, I think, a better clinical picture than me going through that and trying to pick out exactly what you want. But we do have substantial data.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is that a link that we could be sent, or the data? Could you send that to the committee?
I will send it to the committee, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Benson. Just actually a comment in regards to the question asked by Representative Mina. In my experience, for folks that are doing this work on a daily basis, they not only have extra staff time dedicated to this, but many of them spend at least a day or two a week on prior authorizations alone. And it is a exceptional add to their time spent outside of seeing patients or dealing with patient care. And that's my experience, and I'm not sure if Ms. Venchin can attest to that as well.
Through the chair, yes, I have heard similar. Their medical offices have dedicated staff that do nothing but try to work their way through all of these prior authorization requirements. and they often spend hours on the phone waiting to get through, only to have it denied. When they get a medical reviewer, the reviewer often has no expertise in the area under question, and it's a very time-consuming effort, and certainly adds to the cost of doing business as a medical provider.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Vention?
One more.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Hit the chair for Ms. Vention. Another question I have is just related to some feedback that prior authorization helps with waste and ensuring evidence-based practices. Could you address some of those concerns by insurance companies?
Yes, that is the claim by the insurance companies. But what this bill does, and bills similar to this in other states, if a provider or a physician has, you know, 80% of the time their prior authorizations are approved, the chances of fraud and waste go way down. If, you know, if half of their prior authorization requests are denied, that raises a little more question. But that's why the 80% is written into this bill, that for a provider who reliably eventually gets prior authorization approval, this would reduce the burden significantly. And those that don't have that reputation of being reliably necessary, those would still need to go through the prior authorization process.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Fenton? Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Fenton. And we also have, I guess, available for questions. Director of the Division of Insurance, Lori Winghire, and on the phone, Ezekiel Silva, MD from the Texas Medical Association. Did they just questions? No. Sorry? Oh, okay. That sounds like a plan. Mr. Silva, did you want to provide testimony on House Bill 187?
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you, committee members, for this opportunity. For the record, my name is Dr. Zeke Silva. I'm a physician. I practice interventional radiology. I'm in San Antonio, Texas. I am speaking in support of House Bill 187 before you. Reiterate the points made, but to emphasize those even to a greater degree as a practicing physician. You know, we spend nearly 2 days per week on nothing but prior authorizations. While that creates costly administrative burdens for us, honestly, our greater concern is the harm that we see to our patients. AMA survey data shows approximately one-third of physicians report that prior authorization leads to significant delays in patient care, including hospitalizations, permanent physical impairment, and even sometimes disability and death. Texas Medical Association ourselves have similar data. Around 38% of our physicians report a serious adverse event occurring. This prompted action from our Texas Medical Association and our state legislature in 2021 to pass a bill that is very similar to the one being discussed here. We were able to have that bill passed at one end of law in mid-2021, and we're seeing the benefits of that currently within our patients and our relationships with our health plans, but in particular in the ability to better represent our patients and make proper clinical judgments regarding those patients. And when our physicians have, in our state, we determine gold card in context to having that pre-approval, the 80% being discussed in House Bill 187. And we feel it allows our physicians who consistently receive prior authorization to maintain those exemptions and continue to provide quality care to the patients of our state. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Silva? Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other questions from the committee? Ms. Winghire, I have a question for the Division of Insurance, if you would please come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Prox. For the record, I'm Lori Wing-Heyer, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for coming down today. Do you have any insight from the perspective of the Division of Insurance? Has there been complaints about prior authorizations, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, of course there has been.
Yep. Why are we
this
here?
It's a very emotional bill for many people. Because when you want your healthcare service, you want it now. On the other hand, we all look to our healthcare insurers and providers to find ways to reduce cost. This is a mechanism that was put in place to make sure that as a patient, you're receiving the proper care, the proper treatment for your diagnosis. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. But the providers will tell you it will reduce cost, as you've heard from some of the testimony, in decreasing staff and increasing when someone can be seen and receive the treatment. The insurance companies or the payers are going to tell you exactly the opposite. If we don't have a chance to review the treatment to see that it's proper, it's going to increase costs. Mm-hmm. But there's no, I mean, we have a process that if you go through the insurance company to have your authorization approved, if you don't agree with it, then we have a process for an external review that we already administer at the division. And yes, we do get requests to go through the external review.
And thank you. This is Chair Prox again. Do you have studies, experience, data to give us an indication if this is the right balance? I believe that in the statute, I believe it was 80% of the requests for authorizations go through, the physician is no longer required to provide pre-authorizations.
Mr. Chairman, we don't have that data at the division. I could see what I could find, but off the top of my head, we do not track how – we track our own data. I can tell you how many we get a year as far as performing external health reviews, but it's not a great enough number, I think, to sway anyone's opinion of this bill.
Am I to understand the percentage of appeals is relatively insignificant?
Mr. Chairman, the ones that we get to do the external review is pretty small. How many people go to the insurance company direct and ask for a grievance, if you will, to look at prior authorization? I'd have to go and do a data call on the insurance companies to tell you that number.
Okay. Is that something that is reasonable to ask for? Can that be readily available? You would have to call the insurance companies. We would expect that they would be tracking that, correct?
Yes, sir, I would be. And it would take a couple weeks at least for them to pull it to see how many grievances they had filed as far as prior authorizations.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions of Ms. Wing-Heyer, Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Through the Chair, Ms. Wing-Heyer. I'm somewhat familiar with the prior authorization issue and the competing stresses and pressures and interests and so forth, but I'm going to bypass that for the time being. I'm interested more in what would constitute or what does constitute a utilization review entity. The definition on page 4 of the bill is especially for subparagraph E, gives me a little bit of brain freeze. Just what is a utilization review entity? Are such creatures operating in Alaska right now? Who are they? Help me understand more about utilization review entities.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, they do exist in Alaska. I will have to get back with you with the names, but that is who we use for our external review. And we have pretty tight practices that if you submitted to me that you wanted to have your claim reviewed for prior authorization or how the treatment was being handled, we have less than 24 hours to turn it around to get it to the external review and to have it get it. Then they have a very short time frame to get it back to you so that you get an answer. I will get back to you with the names of who we have under contract.
Representative Sadler.
Just the workflow. The workflow through the chair, Ms. Wing-Heyer. If somebody puts a claim in for services, provider, the insurance company asks for prior authorization, a PA, that goes to you, the Division of Insurance, it goes to a utilization review entity, they give it back to you, then back to the, what trace all the different steps and the information.
Through the chair, my understanding of the process, if you submitted, your insurance company would say yay or nay for the prior authorization. If you were not happy with that, and if your provider was not happy with that, then it would come to us for almost like a second opinion. And then we would ask for an external review of the claim, an independent, if you will.
And keep going through the chair. So once that external entity, then what would be the flow of the case, the file, whatever?
Through the chair, that would be the end of us where we are concerned. Once the opinion comes back or the advisory comes back from the external review, then the decision is made that it is either necessary or not.
But that it goes back to the insurer, the provider? They don't just make a decision and don't tell anybody?
No, I'm sorry. Through the chair, they would tell all of the parties, the provider, the insurer, and the patient.
Thank you.
Questions? I think this is Chair Prox. I think this might be for the bill sponsor, but whomever has the answer would be great. As I understand the bill, once a service provider, if you will, qualifies that fewer than 20%, it's 80% of their requests go through, then they no longer need to be submitting requests for review. What isn't clear is that a lifetime exemption, or is there some, what is the periodic check?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sumner for the record. So it does say in section 2, line 8, a utilization review entity may evaluate whether a healthcare provider continues to qualify for an exemption under this section, not more than once every 12 months. So I believe it would be envisioned that as much as, you know, once a year, they can review this and make a redetermination. Of course, nothing in here prevents them from providing the exemption for a longer period of time if they have reason to believe that there's no issue and they don't need a review, then they could probably, I suppose, give them a lifetime exemption. But
if I may, I guess this would be a post authorization review, but they would then, am I envisioning this correctly from the insurer's point of view? They would look through the claims provided by the physician and then have to do some process of whether they thought that was appropriate or not. Am I having the right expectation?
Mr. Chair, so the utilization review entity would review claims submitted over the prior 12 months if they review after 12 months and make a determination if 80% or more would have been accepted or acceptable, then they would continue their exempt status. Otherwise, it could be revoked.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Representative Sumner and Ms. Hackenmiller. And we will hold this bill for now for further questions and proceedings, and we will go on to House Bill 260, Catastrophic Illness Medical Assistance, sponsored by Representative Stapp. Perfect timing. Representative Stapp and his assistant, Honor Miller, would you please come forward and bring us up to date on your bill?
For the record, my name is Representative Will Stapp.
And for the record, my name is Honor Miller Austin, staff to Representative Will Stapp.
And HB 260, CAMA.
That was easy.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Fields.
I think Representative Mina and I have a caucus meeting with the senator, and so in the interest of timeliness, I would move that the committee advance this bill from committee. Thank you.
Do we have any objection to advancing this bill from committee? And with that, we will do just exactly that.
I guess I would just note, I don't think there were any amendments present or offered. Thank you.
No, thank you.
We could make an official motion, I think, Mr. Chair. Yes, we have it right here, Representative Rufford.
Yes, thank you, Chair Prox. I move House Bill 260, version 33-LS1085/B from committee with attached individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
And seeing no objections, House Bill 260 moves from committee. And we have the paperwork. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Back on record, our next order of business is House Bill 258, General Relief and Burial Assistance, which is also sponsored by Representative Staff. And here to assist him is his able a staff member, Honor Miller, Representative Staff.
Thank you, Co-Chair, or excuse me, Chair Prox. For the record, my name is Representative Will Staff and my staff.
My name is Honor Miller Austin, staff to Representative Will Stapp.
And we also have Deb Effridge, Director, Division of Public Assistance. And we have, I am seeing two amendments. I'm seeing way more than that. I'm seeing 4 minutes. Just a moment.
I'll move amendment number one.
Well,
if you want
to. I was just looking, right, checking if there was. We can go on with the amendments. I just wanted to check that we had public testimony.
Okay. I'll move amendment number one.
Okay. There's been an objection, Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Definitely appreciate Representative Staff offering this bill and trying to figure out a way to get good return on our social services relative to administrative costs. So amendment number one takes the current statutory $500 resource threshold, which hadn't been updated in many years, and it updates it to be $1,500. It also clarifies that personal resources don't include credit. So, you know, a homeless person living in a very old car who has taken out a credit card to buy food to survive under this amendment perhaps could still access general relief. As I think we've discussed, really the main type of situation where I've encountered general relief being used is for very time sensitive shelter, largely coordinated by homeless service agencies in Anchorage, you know, with a resource threshold of $500, someone with the oldest car in Anchorage might you know, be living in their car homeless yet not able to access general relief. So this very modest change of the threshold is simply meant to address that. Thank you.
Do you have any comments? Do you maintain Representative Sadler?
I'm sure. With your indulgence, I would ask you, the chair, if the sponsor of the bill has any thoughts on Amendment 1.
Yeah. For the record, Representative Stapp, thank you through the chair to Representative Sadler. Certainly appreciate the amendment. So there's actually several issues, I think. Number one, I'm not sure where the number 1500 comes from, but to me, the instant aspect is, okay, the cost of the program goes up exponentially because now you have effectively been able to qualify a bunch of people who would not normally have qualified. There's also a bunch of other programs that these folks are already entitled to that they do qualify for. I would be very cautious about not including the word credit under personal resources. Credit doesn't necessarily mean debt. It could just mean access to credit lines, right? So you could, in theory, benefit someone who has the access to a whole bunch of credit. So appreciate it. I just don't support it for various reasons. I would be curious from the sponsor, though. It is the prerogative of the committee to know where the number actually comes from in the amendment. So.
Thank you. Good question. That number was actually calibrated at the value of a very old car for people who are living in their car trying to seek shelter, which again is just the real world example I've run into. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nothing. Representative Mina. Oh, any other questions, comments on the amendment? Representative Sumner, I believe, do you maintain your objection? Okay, with that, would you please call the roll?
Representative Mina.
Yes.
Representative McCormick.
Yes.
Representative Rutherford.
Absent.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Sumner.
No.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Chair Fox.
No. And so by a vote of 3 yeas to 3 nays, the amendment fails.
Brief and ease.
On the record.
Thanks, Mr.
Amendment
Chairman.
2.
I will move Amendment 2.
Representative Fields moves Amendment 2. Is there an objection to Amendment 2? Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think, again, appreciate the bill sponsor for identifying the issue of opportunities to improve efficiency and administration and general relief. I think having identified opportunities for improvement, there's sort of two paths forward. One is eliminate certain major provisions from the program. The other path forward is try to make administration of those types of relief more efficient. So amendment number 2 seeks to make provision of rent and utility assistance more efficient by making essentially relief of the last resort. So rather than have a bunch of applicants check a general relief box, which, good point from the bill sponsor, is maybe a little misleading for some applicants, what amendment number 2 does is essentially say, hey, if there is someone in need and these and other department programs don't work, we're giving the department some authority or direction to use general relief as that relief of last resort. So hopefully this would be less time consuming for the department, still provide relief of last resort and achieve greater efficiency, given that the program would still exist for rent and utility assistance. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Stapp, would you like to comment on the amendment, please?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Prox, through the chair to Representative Fields. Again, appreciate the amendment. So I'm not entirely sure if we think that it's going to work that way. So when I read this amendment, it looks to me like basically you're going to force the department to do a lot more administrative burden by taking everyone who gets denied a program or doesn't qualify for a program who goes and fills out something at the department to automatically have to be processed through this avenue. And especially when you consider the requirements of the program are already very low, right? I tend to think it might actually work backwards. That would be my thought. Certainly open to working it out, though. I just don't necessarily know that this would be the proper language. So that's all I have to say.
Good. Thank you. Other comments on Amendment 2? Representative Sumner, do you maintain your objection? And with that, would you please call the roll?
Representative Felix.
Yes.
Representative
Neely. Yes.
Representative
McCormick. Yes.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Sumner.
No.
Chair Prom.
No.
Two yeas, four nays.
So with a vote of 3 yeas and 4 nays, Amendment 2 fails. And we go on. Representative Fields, Amendment 3.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment 3.
There has been an objection. Representative Fields, would you like to speak to your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, one of the positive things that this bill identifies is that the extremely low threshold for rent and utility assistance is inefficient when administered on a monthly basis. Again, in my experience in Anchorage, which I acknowledge is just one community, the real-world utility of general relief is for time-sensitive homeless assistance. And what Amendment Number 3 does is provide the department authority to meet the overall general relief threshold over a six-month period, but provide that in lump sum. And what that means, in effect, is instead of providing $70 a month, if there is a person at immediate risk of homelessness, general relief could be used for, say, housing someone in an apartment or assisted living for, say, 4 or 5 days all at once, rather than trickling out $70 over 6 months. Yeah, $70 a night is a fairly useless amount of money in terms of providing shelter in most of our communities. So, again, this is within the admittedly very small amount of money that general relief represents, an attempt to provide that time-sensitive shelter potential for those people who would qualify. Thank you.
Good. Representative Stapp, would you like to comment on Amendment 3?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Prox, through the chair, Ingen, for the record, this representative staff. So, mechanics of this. So, when it comes to utility assistance, the department, and if I say anything incorrect, we do have the wonderful Director Etheridge here. The department basically has to negotiate with the third party provider, right? And they do so on a month by month basis because that's how they're verified for, right? So, I don't think you could do a lump sum on that, so the mechanics of that would be weird. But kind of my main objection here is, again, I'm not even sure of the homeless coordinator example that the Representative Fields reaches out, because I actually did have my staff reach out to homeless coordinators, and what, you know, the information they gave us is, I don't want to paraphrase it, but I got to kick it off to my staff so they can maybe discuss the conversation with the homeless coordinator. If the permission of the chair, just to kind of see what they actually do. So,
please.
Through the chair, my name is Honor Miller Austin, staff to Representative Will Stapp. And I did have a conversation with a homeless coordinator. His name is Brian Wilson. And he works out of an office here in Juneau. And I talked with him about some of the programs that he thinks are effective that work for him and also other communities within Alaska. And he referenced the emergency housing vouchers, sponsor-based rental assistance. We also have Section 8 housing, housing choice vouchers, and emergency rental assistance programs. And he also is working on doing a more open door policy for those who are in need or facing homelessness in Alaska, and they are making it more of less going into different places and finding that they need to go elsewhere. They're trying to make it more universally equal opportunity for people to find the housing that they need in that time frame.
Thank you. Representative Mina,
Thank you, Chair Prox, through the chair. Thank you, Ms. Miller, for providing some of the other emergency shelter aid that's out there. I do think that it's really important at this time when costs have been rising and a lot of people are struggling that we do have as many options as possible. And the housing vouchers that are out there are great, but sometimes there can be a little bit of a delay. And so that's just on my mind in terms of general relief within the state as an option.
Would Director Etheridge like to comment on this, on how it works?
Chair, would you mind if I respond to Representative Mina?
Oh, sure. Representative Stapp.
Yep. Again, for the record, it's Representative Stapp. Thank you, through the chair. No, I appreciate that. I would actually say you made my argument. A lot of the homeless coordinator stuff is very time sensitive. And quite honestly, I do not believe that we should want to run time sensitive emergency benefits through DPA. That's kind of the nucleus of the argument of the bill. So thank you.
Director Etheridge.
For the record,
do you have any comments for us?
For the record, my name is Deb Etheridge. I'm the director for the Division of Public Assistance. And after the last hearing on this, I got into some more detail around the payment for shelter in particular. Generally, the division will receive a general relief application for shelter frequently. It is of individuals who are currently receiving a subsidies for shelter and are at risk of eviction. And so there's a pretty low threshold, and they do tend to, we see duplicate, so month after month, and so applications that might come in for the same person, maybe for a few months, and so that does happen within the division, and along with that, generally, to speak to the hotel, the maximum amount that we can for the benefit is $120. And so we do call if someone were to apply and need a hotel room. And remember, it's just $120 for the month. So we would call and agree for payment. And we would have to have the hotel agree to accept a payment that would arrive within 7 to 10 business days.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Ms. Etheridge, I'm glad you're up there because I was just looking at 4725130 that, as you say, says the monthly benefit may not exceed $120 a month. But this amendment would indicate, seemingly, that up to 6 months in a lump sum, can you reconcile those two? Are they in conflict or am I misinterpreting that?
Through the chair, Representative, the benefit amount right now, as said, is $120 per month. And an individual must apply each month for the benefit. I believe, and I haven't had a lot of time to think about the amendment, but I believe this would allow a six-month eligibility period where that, if this is the intention, that $120 could potentially be issued in a lump sum, but would not be eligible for more than.
Mr. Chairman.
But again, I forgive me, I don't. Through the chair.
Mr. Chairman, I can try and clarify that.
Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just an attempt to provide clarity. Yes, I cited the wrong number, 70, not 120. It is 120. The intention under the amendment is to allow the 6 months of $120 per month, so $720, to be used within a month. So in the event of someone needing shelter, you know, maybe they can get a hotel room at a cheaper hotel for, say, 3, 4, 5 days. And I do appreciate the bill sponsor reaching out to one of the homeless service providers. The last time we had a functioning homeless response system in Anchorage, Nancy Burke was a homeless coordinator. So I asked her if she was concerned about elimination of the program. I also checked with Alaska Legal Services Corporation. They were not concerned about the bill. So I heard different things from multiple institutions and individuals who I respect, but definitely Nancy is one of those who has worked on kind of short-term shelter. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to clarify.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I want to make sure. So if the monthly benefit is $120, the amendment as proposed would allow the that monthly times six would be $720, would allow that $720 to be paid for in 1 month. My question to the director is, Does that contradict section of Title 47-25-130 that limits the amount of assistance to $120 a month?
For the record, Representative Stapp, through the chair to Representative Sadler, I don't know if I could speak to that aspect. I do think it would actually eliminate their eligibility for the program entirely, right? Because their eligibility is capped on assets, right? And that's a minimum of, and I might have to kick the minimum to, I think, $300 in total assets, depending on family size. Maybe it's $400. But if you're going to give somebody $720 a month, that would, in effect, probably make you ineligible. But I'll kick it over to Director Etheridge for the permission to chair.
Through the chair, Representative, the general relief program isn't a benefit paid to the individual. It is a benefit paid to a vendor. So the benefit wouldn't necessarily become an asset to the individual, and the asset is at $500.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. A follow-up through the chair, Ms. Etheridge. So that would mean that a person on whose behalf $720 were paid to a vendor, would that person be eligible to have $120 in each of the subsequent 5 months paid to a vendor, or would they be disqualified for the next 5 months?
Through the chair, Representative, as I said, I just have had just a slight opportunity to read it, and the division right now assumes that it would not exceed $120 a month as a benefit. And so if it were paid in a lump sum, those subsequent months would not, there wouldn't be an eligible benefit during those subsequent months.
Thank you. Director Etheridge. Do you run a 24-hour shop? Are you open to midnight? How does someone take emergency advantage of this?
To the chair, the Division of Public Assistance operates during normal business hours, so 8 to 5 generally for receiving information, Monday through Friday. And we generally... the last interview we start for taking applications over the phone or in person is around 3 p.m., just depending. And we do respond to emergent situations during those times.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just provide a little clarity on that.
Representative Fields.
So it is possible that someone at risk of homelessness could get relief from the division directly. It is probably more likely a homeless service coordinator would see them, perhaps figure out they're eligible for general relief, pay for that through a homeless services provider. Let's just say, hypothetically, this amendment passed. They got them 4 days of shelter at a hotel in a month, and you know they would be then not eligible for expenses in the subsequent 5 months because they would have used their six-month benefit all at once. And then the department would basically reimburse them for that cost, and the money would go to the vendor, a hotel, through the homeless service provider, not to the individual.
You. Any other questions from the committee? Any other comments from the director or the sponsor? Okay. So, Representative Sumner, do you maintain your objection?
Yes.
And then would you please call the roll?
Representative Sumner.
No.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Mina.
Yes.
Representative
McCormick. Yes.
No.
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 4 nays, 2 yays.
So with a vote of 4 nays and 3 nays, 3 yays, the amendment fails. Amendment 4, Representative Mina.
I move Amendment 4.
There's been an objection. Representative Mina, would you like to speak to your objection?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, Amendment 4 retains the rent and utilities assistance part of general relief while keeping the part of the bill that addresses burial services. And I am introducing this amendment because even though the $120 doesn't seem like a big amount, it is a significant amount for people who are at risk of homelessness and who might already be experiencing some forms of homelessness. Additionally, a lot of the argument for the bill is related to the administration and bureaucracy that DPA is facing. And so if I'm weighing between the administrative burden of processing GR applications versus the small amount of people that might benefit, but would benefit greatly because of their situation, my deference is to the latter. And last time we heard this bill, Director Etheridge said that the processing time for general relief, as part of everything else that DPA processes, is nominal. And so I do question some of the arguments in terms of the bill. Additionally, we did receive a letter from the Disability Law Center that if we were to delete the references to shelter in the bill, then it would actually impact a different line item, which is general relief for assisted living homes. This is an item that I've worked on for the past couple of years in my office and then previously as a staffer. And just to talk a little bit about general relief assisted living homes, this is a last resort for individuals who cannot qualify for a Medicaid waiver but are in need of assisted living home services. These are folks who are oftentimes getting discharged from Department of Corrections, from Alaska Psychiatric Institute, from hospitals, but because there aren't enough general relief behavioral health assisted living homes, they are waiting and costing the state a lot more. And so it's a big concern that if we delete this part of the language in law, that it would actually impact a hugely different other program that also supports people who are in need. I worry about that aspect.
Representative Stapp, would you like to comment on the amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Prox, for the recommendation, Representative Stapp. So two-part question here. Thank you so much, Representative Mina. I always appreciate your insight. I think we have the first aspect I say, I think we just have a fundamental disagreement. Second aspect, I will say, I do believe that there is another amendment that specifically addresses the concerns that you have. As far as the first half, you know, nominal is in the eye of the beholder. Like when you look at DPA, the amount of hours and production, I would certainly agree that the amount of time devoted to general relief or these type of, let's call it marginal programs, comparatively to something like Medicaid or SNAP, is absolutely marginal. But when you run just a straight up cost-based analysis, the cost to deliver the $120 for shelter is astronomical based on the value, right? It's not even comparable when you think about payroll, processing time, application time, negotiating with the hospital, or excuse me, with the shelter provider, in this case, a hotel or something like that. So again, the intent of the bill is just to trim, inefficient bureaucratic waste and look at a system of results-based budgeting. And, always open to ways to achieve a result that I think maybe might be intended by the program. I just do not believe that it should still kind of reside in our kind of piece of bureaucracy. So I don't support the minute, but I appreciate you bringing it up.
Thank you. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Fox, through the chair. I appreciate that feedback. I just wanted to respond to one aspect in terms of this amendment in relation to the next amendment. This amendment, it refers to shelter, and so that also covers utilities as well. And so I defer to keeping the language that's still currently in statute and not being so prescriptive to make it specifically assisted living expenses, because that also gives the division flexibility on how they administer the GR program.
Thank you. Are there any other comments? Representative Sumner, do you maintain your objection? Could you please call the roll?
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Sumner.
Pass.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Mina.
Yes.
Representative McCormick. Representative Rufford.
No.
No.
Two yeas, three nays.
So with 2 yeas and 3 nays, the amendment number 4 fails. And let me take a read for these. Back on record, we'll have to void the roll on that amendment. Representative Sumner still maintains his objection. So could we please call the roll on amendment number 4?
Representative Rufford.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Sumner.
No.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Meehan.
Yes.
Representative McCormick. Chair Proctor.
No. So by a vote of 2 yeas and 4 nays, the amendment number 4 fails. And now I'm going to take an at ease. I'll offer Amendment 5. Seeing no objection, Amendment 5 is accepted. Do we have any? I see no other amendments. Do we have any other comments about House Bill 258? Whatever it is, 258. No. So with that, I would entertain a motion. Representative Profich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill 258, version 33-LS1020/B from committee with attached individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes, and this bill will be moved as amended.
Briefies. Back on record, is there an objection to moving the bill out of committee? Seeing none. Seeing no objections, HB 258 moves from committee. We will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. A motion to take House Bill 242 back off the table.
Thank you, Chair Prox. I would move to take House Bill 242 dealing with the extension of senior benefit programs off the table back in front of the committee.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 242 is again before us, and we were at Amendment Number 2, Representative Fields.
Thank you. I move Amendment 2.
Objection.
And there has been an objection. Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a simple amendment that is very confusing to read. So what this amendment does is ensure senior benefits are paid out at the statutory level, which is higher than they have been paid out for the last 5 or 6 years. Thank you.
Thank you.
They have been administratively reduced for the last five or six years. So again, I want them paid out according to statute.
Thank you. And we have Representative Vance in the room. Representative Vance, would you please come forward and comment on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, this is Representative Sarah Vance for the record, House District 6. If I could have just a moment to review this amendment, I apologize that I was running from one meeting to the next. Yep.
And Mr. Chairman, I can provide a little additional context while the bill sponsor re-reviews that. So right now the department has the discretion to pay out at less than the statutory level, which is kind of an additional administrative authority beyond, of course, our ability to appropriate. And I just want to make it our decision ultimately to appropriate and ensure that, you know, we have the greatest likelihood of paying out the statutory level.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on record. Representative Vance, would you like to comment on amendment number 2?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Representative Sarah Vance, and I'm going to remain neutral on this at this time because I don't know if this is going to change the fiscal note. This would be something that the department may have more insight on. I understand this is a wonderful venue for people to be able to appeal the amount of distribution. By principle, I like to apply things equally across law, and I could see that it may create a conflict with other monetary distributions that people receive from the state.
Thank you. Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not certain that deleting this language from statute would have the result that the amendment sponsor believes it would in the event of a insufficient appropriation. I'm actually not sure if they would be able to pay out any money at all if they can't pay out the full benefit if we remove this from statute. And so I guess that would be my concern.
We have someone from the administration that could enlighten us on this subject. Director Etheridge.
For the record, my name is Deb Etheridge. I'm the director for the Division of Public Assistance. And just reviewing the language I see here in front of me today, the division would have to, if we would have to have the appropriations in our budget, in our base budget, and would require that we know exactly the number of individuals who would be applying at which benefit level. If we didn't have those appropriations, we would either have to ask for additional funds through ratification, or it could impact other programs, other state general fund programs.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not wanting to defer too much to the following committees, but also not wanting to make decisions about finances that I'm not sure of, my inclination is to not support this amendment and let the division know that this question or this amendment is likely to come up later in the process and give her time to do the calculations she just laid out. Thank you.
Good idea. Representative Fields.
I was just going to see if Margaret Bergeron from LA Legal is on the line to offer any insight she might have on. She was the one who drafted it. Apparently, she dropped off.
Right. Representative Sumner.
Through the chair, did I hear you right that if this amendment passed and then the appropriation was not made, you would essentially impound from other services and still pay out the benefit?
Through the chair, Representative, the Division of Public Assistance has several maintenance of effort requirements, and so we have to spend general fund dollars to meet those maintenance of effort, and I feel like I need additional time to review the impact to this and if it would impact other programs.
I remove my objection.
I object.
Representative Sadler.
I've stated my concerns already.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Representative Sumner.
No,
Representative Rufford. Sorry.
Okay. Yes. Through the chair, I guess I just wanted to make sure I had a very similar question to Representative Sumner, that if the division is not allowed to essentially short the benefit if the appropriation does not match, what you're saying is you do have an obligation, if required by statute, to fund this program to find those dollars somewhere you think. But I get that you would need time to say that for sure, but that is an accurate statement.
Through the chair, Representative, again, this is Deb Etheridge. I just saw this, and to the best of my ability, if we're obligated to pay at a level in statute, it strikes me that we would have to pay those benefits at that level.
Okay.
Okay. Any other comments? Representative Sadler, do you maintain your objection?
Yes, sir, I do.
Thank you. Would you please call the roll?
Representative Meenan.
Yes.
Representative McCormick. Representative Rufford.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Sumner.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Chair Prox.
No.
Three yeas, three nays.
So by a vote of three yeas and three nays, the amendment fails. I have no more amendments. So any other comments on House Bill 242? With that, I would entertain a motion. Representative Rufford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill 242, version 33-LS1121/B from committee with attached individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Do we have any objections? Seeing no objections, House Bill 242 moves from committee, and we will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Are there any other comments or questions from the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned at 5:22. Thank you much.